I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Dottie Shore. Hi. Oh, you know, this waiting has been just terrible. I don't know. It's nice to be the last speaker because you get so much inspiration from the speakers beforehand. But my God, the days go by and your mouth gets drier and your hands get wetter and it's just not working out. I'm grateful to God and I'm grateful to all you people for having me here. I was born and raised in Reno. This is my hometown. And I've often thought when I was first early sober, if they ever invited me back to speak at a high school reunion, they'd probably run me out of town if I told them the story. But coming back to Reno and speaking at AA meetings is an entirely different ball game. There's no doubt of it. My grandfather and grandmother came in from Maine and homesteaded in Reno. And my grandfather was a contractor, and he built the courthouse and all the schools. My mother was born here, I was born here, and my children were born here. So I love Reno. And it's funny, I've been away from Reno a long time, living in Southern California. And anybody down there mentions Reno, it makes my heart jump. So I guess you can take me out of Reno, but you can't take Reno out of me. And I love it. I'd like to share with you some things that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that were so helpful to me. We do a lot of talking about alcoholism, and we do a lot of talking about the disease, but very few people know anything about our disease. They know how to put us in jail, how to detoxify us, how to give us vitamin B and calcium, and call us a lot of names, but they don't know exactly what's wrong with us. Why are we, the ones that are in this room, why are we alcoholics, and why are some people not? The Institute on Alcoholism is the only medical group that I know that's ever done anything on our research of alcoholism. And many years ago, they put out a paper, and I wish they had it out again. They took 6 alcoholics and hospitalized them until, by blood count and urinalysis, there was no alcohol in their system, and they asked for 6 non-alcoholic volunteers. Now, they took these 12 people, and they gave them a pint of whiskey to drink, and they waited 24 hours for the last drink. They began testing again. In every one of the non-alcoholics, they found it totally out of the body or in the bladder. However, in every one of the alcoholics, they found it in the spinal fluid. Now, they found out that we have what they call a biochemical imbalance. We have a gland that fails to function. They know the pancreas fails in the diabetic, but they don't even know the gland that fails to function in you and I. They call it an X factor. I've got an X factor here someplace that doesn't work very good. But once that breaks down, either by the use of alcohol or never functions, and I don't believe it ever functions in my case, we take alcohol in any form, it will not burn up, oxidize, and go through the proper channels. It'll go into the bloodstream, to the spinal fluid, into the brain. Now, the first part of our brain is alcoholics. It's affected when we drink. Is the frontal part that contains the I care factor. And so when you and I drink, the first thing is killed and turned. Oh, you think that's funny, don't you? But you see, if someone came up here today and shot me in the front of the head here with a Novocaine needle, and I started doing the crazy things I did when I was drinking, no one would call me a no good woman or a drunken bum. They would do what they could to take care of me until my brain came back. We have a biochemical imbalance. We have a tremendous personality change. We're from Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and people wonder why. They'll say, gee, she's such a nice person. When she drinks, she's hell on wheels. Have you ever heard that before? So with my brain knocked out, it's no wonder. All right, so we know we have an allergy of the body. An allergy is, the want of a better word, an allergic reaction is something you take either in the mouth, orally, or breathe through the nostrils as a pollen, or touch against the skin. These are allergic reactions to things your body can't tolerate. So they say we are allergic to alcohol. We find out we're alcoholic, we come into Alcoholics Anonymous if we're lucky. Some people never make it. You know, some people never have 2 days back-to-back of sobriety. So you who are here today, if you've had sobriety since you got up this morning, you have a pearl of great price, because at least you've got a few hours of sobriety. Many people that I know have died without even having a few hours. And so we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they explain to us that we have a second part of our disease. And I was very glad, because I worked in pharmacy for many years, and I used to have diabetic people come to the counter, and I would they'd be weeping and crying. They'd been diagnosed as diabetic, and I'd help them with their insulin and some of the things we had to tell them to do. But in a few days, or a week at the most, they would accept the fact they are diabetic and go on about their business. Now, what happens to you and I? We find out we're allergic. We know alcohol is killing us. I thought so much about Ted last night, pancreatitis and vomiting blood and all that, and people telling him that. Now, why wasn't that enough for Ted? Why isn't it enough for you and I? Because we have a second part of our disease that's so mysterious. It's called the obsession of the mind. Now, no one that has ever not had an obsession of the mind can understand what the hell we're talking about. Now, what are you talking about? That's a cop-out, an obsession of the mind. Well, the book puts it better than I in chapter 3. It says the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that somehow, some way, someday, we're going to control and enjoy this. The delusion is astonishing. Many will pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. And so we have an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. Now, if we're fortunate, we get to Alcoholics Anonymous. And we come out of this terrible shell of loneliness that we've lived in for so long. And people love us and they accept us. And we go to meetings. And maybe we become a circuit speaker. And we become a secretary of a group. And we empty coffee cups. And we go out on 12-step calls. And everything's wonderful. We just seem so happy. And then, if that's as far as we go, the day will come when you'll say to yourself, geez, is that all there is to sobriety? Is that all there is to AA? Well, if that's all there is, let's break out the booze and have a ball. You've heard the sick song that Peggy Lee has sung for so long. And that must have been an alcoholic that wrote that song, you know it? That's all there is, let's break out the booze and have a ball. Wow. Anyhow, that's what happens. Now, what makes people come in and learn about their disease as far as the allergy of the body, the obsession of the mind, and lose the enthusiasm and the honeymoon for Alcoholics Anonymous? Because there's a third part of our disease, my dear friends, that I think is so totally neglected. And the third part is a spiritual illness. Please, dear ones, remember, we're not a body walking around. We get our body physically dry and we say, well, I'm fine now, and it's not what we need. Many of us come into AA and we go back to school. You heard it mentioned in several of the speakers. And we become, clear in the mind. But we're not just a mind walking around. Our spiritual illness, we are body, mind, and spirit. And we get sick in three ways. We must be healed in three ways. Now, a lot of people come in and they go to church and read the Bible and they get so heavenly minded, they're noticeably good. And they ain't going to do it either. That's not going to do it either. See, we have always been tilted or lopsided. We've never been a total human being somehow. And AA, if you apply it the way it's supposed to be, you will, I promise you, be a total human being. Because, dear ones, if it can happen to me, it can happen to you. The AA book tells me a great deal about the spiritual side. It says, and I don't like the word spiritual side because it is a spiritual program. It says, no human power can relieve alcoholism, but God can and will if sought. It says, lack of power is our dilemma. All the time I thought booze was my problem. What do they mean, lack of power? Do they mean brain power? No, most of us are too damn smart for our own good. We really are. We're highly emotional, easily upset, and very sensitive, and I love it. Now, they don't mean physical power. That isn't the lack of power they're talking about, because there's, females and males, and there's frail people, and there's strong people in here. So it's not that power. What kind of power are they talking about? Lack of power is our dilemma. Well, lack of power of a contact with a power greater than ourselves that I choose to call God. Now, this will be my opinion, and you'll find out I'm terribly opinionated before I get through, because all this is my opinion. It really isn't, because my opinion's got me drunk. My opinions that I'll give you today is something I've stolen from everybody else. But I believe that when we were born, we had no problem with our higher power. It's very easy to teach children about God. Very easy. They love to say their prayers, and they love to talk to God. And I think they've got an extension cord that's plugged into God. But somewhere along the line, our parents get a hold of us, and a few ministers get a hold of us, and the teachers get a hold of us, and you and I get so disillusioned, we just pull our plug out. And we've got this long extension cord, and we're just swinging the plug around here, not knowing where the hell to plug it in. You know, just not knowing. All of a sudden, you see that bottle of bourbon, or Cutty Sark, or beer, and you just, oh, man, do we have power now. So people come to me and they'll say, I don't believe in that higher power stuff. I'll say, oh, don't you? You got a higher power called booze. It plays the tune, you do the dance. And all we ask you to do is to take your life out of the destructive power and find a power greater than yourself. It may be your sponsor for a while. It may be the group. But lack of power is our dilemma. And so we have to find a power greater than ourselves. Now, the book says there is one who has all power. That one is God. And at the end of our meeting, we'll say the Lord's Prayer, and we'll say, for thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory. So we are lacking in power. We do not have an outside power that we need. We've gone on guts and willpower until we've lost guts. They say that we have no willpower. My God. What does it take to get up in the morning, a chronic alcoholic, and take 5 straight shots down and vomit them all up for one will stay? That takes willpower, as far as I'm concerned. We don't have any womb power, but we sure don't have any willpower. So we find ourselves in this terrible dilemma. And the stigma, the word is a stigma, alcoholic. I used to say to my sponsor, for God's sake, call me a drunk or a lush, but don't call me that dirty word, alcoholic. And it was very difficult for me. And she looked in the book one day, and she opened it up, and she said, you know, Dottie, doesn't say anything in this book. You have to like it. But you damn well better accept it. Now, as I began to accept the fact that I was an alcoholic, I began to like it. I thought, thank God. Oh, thank God there's a reason why I fouled up all my life. Thank God I'm just not a weak, no-good mother, and a no-good wife, and a no-good daughter, and a no-good friend. I'm a woman who suffers from a killer terminal illness called alcoholism. And I can get well in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started my drinking here in Reno. I was full-blown alcoholic when I left. Got down to California, it was going to be different down there, you understand? It was all these people in Reno that did this thing to me. Oh, my. I couldn't wait to get away from my mother. My mother was a very dominating matriarch person, and I couldn't wait to get away from her. And I had a sister 2 years older than I was, and one 9 years younger. The one that was 2 years older was a radio singer, junior champion skier, and a model, and adored by my mother. And I was caught between these two people, and I wanted to get away. And so when I got to California, I thought it was going to be great. When I got to California, I missed my mother so bad I couldn't stand it. I had to write to her every day and call her twice a week on the telephone. And this was a woman I couldn't wait to get away from. So I was just terribly, terribly sick. I was emotionally crippled. I was in a bad way. Well, I drank for 19 years. I think I was a long time periodic. I never drank alcohol as a beverage. I never had a beer on a hot afternoon or before dinner. I have no idea what a social drinker is. I don't think I'd like them anyhow, so I'm not going to try and find out. I laughed. I heard one of the speakers say something about social drinkers. I went out to dinner not too long ago with a group of people, and the reservations were held up, so we had to go to the bar. And I had my usual tonic and lime, and they were drinking. And so when it came time to have our dinner, they went to the table, and all of them brought their glass to the table. And almost immediately they served a salad, and they set their drink there. And I became so fascinated with those lousy drinks that are only half done that I couldn't even eat my salad. And I thought, well, what are they going to do with them? It was very interesting. And they, you know, took a couple of sips, and then the salads were taken away, and something else came, and the waitress said, are you through with your drinks? And they said, yeah, and I wanted to go, no, no, no. You know, geez, they haven't changed very much all this time. But if that's a social drinker, you can keep them, because I never drank like that. So anyhow, I finally became a chronic alcoholic, and the last 4.5 years of my drinking, I drank the clock around. I was never drunk, and I was never sober. I nipped all day. Now, during the Christmas holidays of 1949 and 1950, I came back to Reno. It was the first time I'd come back since I went away, and it was for a Christmas party with my family. And when I got back here, my mother had been writing to me and complaining about my sister, and I thought, thank God she's after her now instead of me. But when I saw my sister, I almost dropped dead. My sister was a chronic alcoholic, and she was a bar type. And she was a radio singer and a junior champion skier and a model, and she was beautiful. And she developed cirrhosis of the liver to the place where her stomach had swelled the size of a 9-month pregnancy. She was wearing dirty blue jeans and a maternity jacket, and she was running the streets of Reno like a bum. And I was horrified. And I said to my brother-in-law at that time, my God, can't you do something about her? And he said, well, Dottie, we've tried everything. We've hospitalized her. We've taken her to a psychiatrist. He said, if you don't think I've tried everything, I even called a bunch of people that call themselves Alcoholics Anonymous. And they can't help her because she doesn't want help. Now, dear ones, that's the sum total of anything I ever heard about AA. And certainly it wasn't for me. I was full-blown alcoholic at that time, but I didn't think I was. And so it terrorized me. And when we got back, we left between before New Year's to go back to California. And on the way home, my husband said to me, God, I hope you never get to be like your sister. And I said, don't be silly. I've got too much intelligence to let a thing like that happen to me. But see, it scared me. And so I thought, well, I'll go on my last drunk on New Year's. Nobody ever gets drunk on sober on New Year's. When I said that, people came up and said, I got sober on New Year's. So everything I say, you know, I can be people can say it's different. The month of January of 1950 was the most hell I've ever gone through. Because I never suffered hangovers. I drank the clock around. But I tried to withdraw from alcohol. And I went into hallucinations and blackouts that terrorized me. I was a secret drinker by this time. I would hide the bottle. I would start to take a drink, and I'd see people with their eyes up like this looking in the window. So I'd go around, pull all the window shades down, take a drink, go around, pull them all back up again. I was the tardest drunk that got to AA, I swear. And then I had hallucinations. I'd see foam coming through the hardwood floors. When they had the space program, you know, where they went into weightlessness, I did that long before they did. Stepped on that foam and I would just bounce off the ceiling and off the side of the walls. I was total in weightlessness, absolutely terrorized, trying very hard not to drink. And I would get through till about 3 o'clock in the afternoon and then I'd get drunk. On February 8th, 1950, I came out of a blackout with someone saying, North Hollywood AA Clubhouse. Now, dear ones, I don't remember if I ever looked it up in the phone book, whether I had the operator get it for me. I will never tell you, because I don't know. And I asked the lady on the phone, how do you know if you're an alcoholic? And she said, is it for you or your husband? I said, for my husband, of course. Then I started to blubber and cry, as only an alcoholic can blubber and cry. And she said, don't kid me, it's for you, isn't it? And I said, yes. And she says, I'll be right out. And I said, oh, you can't come out. My God, I don't want my husband to know I'm an alcoholic. And she said to me later, she thought, she says, I got an alcoholic and a ding-a-ling on the other end of that line. So she said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll come out in the morning on one condition. You're not drinking. I don't want to talk to a bottle. I want to talk to you. I said, okay. So when my husband came home that night, I set him in a chair. I'm not dramatic, you understand? I set him in a chair with his back to me. And I said, now don't look at me. I want to tell you something. I said to him, I'm an alcoholic and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And his shoulders started going like that. And I said, oh, God, please don't laugh at me. He turned around with tears coming out of his eyes. And he said, God, I'm not laughing. He said, I was getting the commitment papers for Camarillo. I thought you were out of your mind. So I squeaked that far into getting away from Camarillo. I think if they'd locked me up, I would have gone over the brink. There's no doubt about it. I was terrorized. You ought to see what I did in that little hotel room they gave me, that little oversized closet I'm sleeping in. Almost went across the brink, too, in that one. But my higher power helped me with that one. Anyhow, so I told him, I said, I told about the two children there, and I said, girls, I've got a wonderful thing to tell you. I said, 1 week from tonight, I'm going to have a big surprise for you. I thought it was going to take 1 week, and you guys would get me all sober and all cleaned up. Give me a shot or do something. I don't know what you're going to do, but I was going to give you every chance. I remember about 10 days later, after I got to AA, my daughter said to me, what was that big surprise you were going to have? And I said, well, I'm not drinking anymore. She said, oh, is that all? All the time I thought this was going to be a big deal. Well, on February 8th, 1950, I went to my first meeting. Now, that was 30 years ago. You got to know that. They put me in a wheel buggy and wheeled me in. I was just a baby alcoholic. You see, that was 30 years ago, and I'm only 39, so I was very young, you understand? Oh, I heard some nasty laughs out there. And I attended my first meeting. I weighed 82 pounds. I was suffering from malnutrition. My tongue, the taste buds on my tongue stuck up, and I couldn't drink coffee. From malnutrition, from vitamin deficiency. My lips were splitting at the corner and bleeding. They took a long time to heal. And all these bumps under my neck, the doctor said were vitamin deficiency bumps. I looked about 65 years old, and I was terrorized. Totally terrorized. And that's the way I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I sat in the front row. I saw the birthday cake celebration that night. We have birthday cakes, I'm sure you do here, as a year candle for each year of sobriety. And I saw the people up there on the podium, and God, I was so impressed. My sponsor was 3 years sober. It seemed like an eternity when I couldn't go 24 hours without a drink. And they had corsages on, and they gave him presents, and they patted him on the back. And I had sat in audiences for years and watched my sister Evelyn. I'd watched her get cups for skiing, and I'd seen her model, and I'd seen her sing. And my little sick mind said, geez, all I got to do is not drink for a year. And I'll be up here getting my cake, and you'll be down there looking up at me. And I went dry for a year. Now, the man that talked that night talked about sanitariums and jails and 502s and 86th out of a bar and convulsions and losing his family. And he terrorized me, and I thought, my God, I scared myself into this thing. I'm not like those people. I didn't drink that much that long or do those things. Well, maybe I'm only a little alcoholic. You can't be a little pregnant. You know, if you got it, you got it. But I tried to identify that night with a drinking pattern. And dear ones, I ask you, please, you may take a long time before you heal your pattern, but please identify with the thinking pattern. It's the stinking thinking that leads to our drinking. And I don't care if you're you know, black, white, young, old. We all think the same. That's the ism. See, most of us have not been booze fighters since we got here. We don't fight alcohol anymore. But the ism is what you and I work on. And that's the stinking thinking that leads to our drinking. So if you identify with people's thinking pattern, you don't have any trouble getting along. I've been very fortunate. You assigned me a delightful young man by the name of Gene, who's been my driver, my transportation man, who's gone above and beyond the call of duty to be good to me. And yesterday he took me all over Reno. He took me up to the Mountain View Cemetery to visit my mother's grave and my sister's grave. And he and I have talked, and he's much younger than I am. And yet in 15 minutes, we were sharing things that would take 25 years of friendship to share, and that's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thank you for the gift of Gene, because I'll always remember him. So that's how AA, and I love it. Well, as I got ready to leave the meeting that night, a man yelled at me, and he said, "Hey, Dottie, don't forget, action is the magic word." I thought he said activity. Nah, I almost killed myself that first year. Well, my weight came back on. I looked better. I think the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous was when I walked through the doors that night. Like I said, I looked like Jeff warmed over. Not one of you people came up and said to me, "My God, put some weight on. Tone your makeup down. How much money do you have? What kind of a car do you drive?" That's what you have to do to belong to any other group, right? They just simply put the warm arms around me, and they said to me, "If you have a problem with alcohol, you're in the right place." And they totally accepted me as I was for the very first time in my life. It was always, "If you just would, if you, when you do this, why don't you do that? You know what I'm talking about." Never accepted as we were. Now, I call this the most magical thing in the world. It's called agape love, spelled A-G-A-P-E. That's God's love. Unconditional. My dear ones, unconditional love. Not as you can be, would be, or should be, but as you are right now. Oh, that's the magic. That's what brings people back. You may have to go out and drink again, but you'll never, ever, in any place in the world, ever find the agape love you'll find here of one alcoholic accepting another. I don't care what you've done or where you've gone. We love you. Didn't you just love Annie's talk the other night? Wasn't she marvelous? Let's give her a hand. I love her so much. Just so great. I think her description of how she, you know, needed love so badly is the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's unconditional love here, and I love that. Well, because I have a gift of gab, you know, I fell in love with my voice at a very early age, and the love affair is still going on. And there was very few women who would speak back there in 1950. And so when they found out I could speak, they put me on the circuit. I was a circuit speaker when I was 49 days dry. Aren't you glad they didn't tape it in those days? God. And so I spoke from Bakersfield to San Diego and any place in between. And God granted me a gift that is phenomenal. It's called a photographic memory. And my sponsor was a book woman, and she quotes from the book, and everybody was so impressed with her, I'd run home, memorize the book, and come back, and, you know, on page 72 it says thus and so, and everybody was so impressed with me. Now, some of these things I have come up with as my own opinion, and you don't have to agree with me, but I think alcoholics are split right down the middle. And I think this side of our personality is totally inferior. And we say we're dumb and we're stupid, and if anybody ever finds out about us, they're going to kick us out of this group. But on the other hand, this side of our personality is totally egocentric, and we say, "God, I'm gorgeous. I'm the best sponsor I ever came across here. I don't know how you people are getting along without me." And the old pendulum swings back and forth till we get totally thrown off balance. I say we're egocentrics with inferiority complexes, and I believe that's true. When I came to you, I was totally stuck on the inferiority side of my personality. I couldn't arrange my hair by myself, buy a dress by myself. I couldn't make the simplest decision of whether to put a coat or a sweater on my children. To arrange furniture was a catastrophe. So I leaned very heavily on people. I remember when I was in California, not used to the weather, I would make my husband scan the sky and guarantee me it wasn't going to rain. Because the worst thing I could do is to hang a washout and have it rain on there. Then everybody knew how dumb I was. I know now I was totally self-obsessed. I thought I was totally inferior, but they have an inferiority complex is ego turned in. And I was just in a house of mirrors and a ball of self. And so it was very, very hard for me. Now, as I came to you people and you started telling me how great I was and I started to believe you, the pendulum started to swing. Had it got somewhere in the middle, I'd have been fine. But it shot to the egocentric side of my personality. And you told me I was great and I agreed with you. Boy, I tell you, I've been looking for you people all my life. Oh, my. It's amazing to me how we can flop from one side of our personality to the other. I think we've always wanted to, be recognized. We've always wanted to stand out a little bit. We say we don't, but we really do. And we do outlandish things sometimes to get it. And then pretty soon you come to a bunch of people called Alcoholics Anonymous, and they love you, and they feed you, and they pet you, and they stroke you. And if you're not careful, dear ones, your ego will take over. And I believe that ego will get you drunk faster than the next drink. If you read AA Comes of Age, you'll read a chapter in there by Dr. Thiebaud, who is a psychiatrist. And he said he wondered why Alcoholics Anonymous was so successful when medical profession wasn't. And being around us, he had found out that what we have is ego deflation at depth. Now, he said the only thing wrong with the ego is it doesn't know it's supposed to be dead. So you're going around, minding your own business, doing your own thing, and the ego comes up like a great big giant shadow behind you and will smash you down. Because I believed my press. I thought I was the greatest thing that ever happened to AA, and I didn't do anything about the program. I taught it. I preached it. I read it. I recited it. I talked about it. Did everything but work it. That's not the name of the game. Photographic memory, and today, dear ones, I can quote you pages of that book. I can give you the preamble, the 12 steps, and the traditions. But my book tells me head knowledge alone is not enough. And I'll guarantee you that head knowledge alone is not enough. And if you get caught up with your own ego, when you think you are something more than you are, when you start taking credit for your sobriety or the babies you worked with, you are in dire trouble. Because I did. I would tell everybody the people I worked with that never got drunk, took all the credit for their sobriety. If I had people that didn't make it, I didn't tell them anything about it. I had one girl that kept getting drunk on me, and she called North Hollywood and would ask for someone to come out and tell them I was her sponsor. And I went over to her house and threatened to beat the hell out of her. She told anybody I was her sponsor. I wasn't going to have any failures. Terrible. God. Can't believe it. Well, the year went by on the wings. I went to work 3 months after I was sober in pharmacy again. My kids got quieted down. My husband got off my back. I went to 365 meetings that first year, really more, because I went to Sunday noon lunches and Monday noon brunches. I spoke practically every night. I worked 40 hours a week. I was just the happiest thing you've ever seen. The year went by, and on February 8th, 1951, I stood at the podium of North Hollywood. My God, I had a corsage stuck out that big, and my family sat in the front row. I had rehearsed my acceptance speech for 6 months. It was magnificent. You should have heard it. And I got more presents than I'd ever gotten in any needle birthday, and I guess I thought I graduated. But man, I really made it. I was in such a high that it was sad. Now, the AA book tells me that we're used to three things: excitement, anxiety, and depression. Peace of mind and a quiet heart we know nothing about. I was in a perpetual state of excitement for over a year. And when you come down off of that thing, you kind of have a hangover. I get real wired when I go on talks like this. And the saddest thing is have to go home and scrub my kitchen floor and clean my bathroom. Obviously, those people there don't know how great I am. I go home and be an old house cleaner. But you do have to come down off of these things. Well, I was really, this year had gone by, and now I got kind of postnatal blues setting in, and I'm an old-timer. So I'm going to sit back now and rest a little bit and let those new people take care of this thing. The first thing I did was break my meeting pattern. Started going on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Now, if I got there I went there on Tuesday, and Thursday night came along, and it was a good television program, or it was too hot or too cold or raining, or maybe the Academy Awards, I didn't go. So I'd get back there the following Tuesday. You know something strange? Nobody ran to the door to greet me. Nobody said, "Where have you been?" They're all staying sober without me. I think, my God, they're a bunch of ungrateful bastards. Nobody even knew I was gone. And I thought, AA, I started thinking, AA is like everything else. They take you, they suck you dry like a lemon, and they throw you away. I had worked my tail off for 16 months, and what are they doing to me? Well, shortly after that, I went to a town called Azusa. I'm sure you've heard of Azusa. Rainstorm just a-coming down. Couldn't hardly see through the windshield, and I got there. Room about half the size of this, and there was a couple old people sitting there. So it comes 8:30, and about six old people are sitting there. And I thought, how dare they ask the great Dottie Shore to come to speak to six old people? Can you imagine doing that? So they'd call me to speak, and I'd screen the group. I'd ask them how big the group was. It was a big group, I went. Small group, I sent one of my babies. Can be bothered that small-time crap. Jeez. Isn't that awful? Hope I never forget that. Well, I had a bad foundation, as you can see. With a foundation laid like this, it was just a matter of time. before something would come across my path, and I'd have 12 tools, and I wouldn't know one from the other how to work them. I remind myself of the two men in the Bible. The one was a foolish man who built his house on sand. Was a wise man who built his house on a rock. And when the storm came and hit the house stood because it was strong. But then there was a foolish man who built his house on sand. And when the storm hit, the house fell, and great was the fall of the house. And see, Dottie sure had built her foundation on sand. And the first storm that came across my path, I would have no foundation, nothing to work on. My sponsor told me during this time that I was having resentments, and I said, I do not have resentments. I have justifiable anger. Couldn't even take the word resentment and buy it. I'd never taken an inventory. I thought booze was my problem. I didn't know what my deep-seated problem is. I hope that you people out there today aren't sitting there thinking booze is your problem. Booze is a very sick answer you found to your problem. If you don't find out what your problem is, you're going to drink again. Now, if you don't drink again, I'll tell you what will happen. And I've seen it happen time and again. Come into AA, put the cork in the bottle, never touch another drop. Become a compulsive overeater. All right, it's true. All right, suppose you come in and you put the cork in the bottle and you never take another drink or become a compulsive overeater. You become an addict. Or, God forbid, a compulsive gambler. Many of those. Or you can become sexually promiscuous and you jump in and out of bed trying to find something that's going to make you feel better. You'll have to find something because, in my opinion, we are wounded people. We're wounded right here at the center of our being. And, dear ones, we put all kinds of dirty bandages on there. Myself, I put marriage and divorce and kids and booze and cigarettes and money and houses and cars and property and prestige and everything you can think of. For a little while, those dirty bandages would stop the wound, and I'd think, ah, now I got it. And within a short time, I was wounded again. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, they ripped the dirty bandages off me and put a clean bandage called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started getting well from the inside out, but not before I had to go out and drink again. Not before I had to have this ego deflation at depth. Now, it's all right for us to have good ego where we care about how we look. We care about what people think about us. But when you start to think that you're better than someone else, you better watch out. Today, you know who I'm better than? I'm better than Dottie Shore used to be. Because if I compare myself today, I'm either better than you or less than you. But if I compare myself to Dottie Shore, I'm better than. And that's the only person, that's the only judge I've got. Am I better than I was yesterday? Yeah. Will I be better tomorrow than I am today? I pray God I will. So therefore, I don't have to worry about judging myself in comparison to someone else, and it makes it a heck of a lot easier to live that way. Well, on June the 10th, 1951, I went to a meeting. It was a beginner's meeting, and they asked for the beginners to raise their hand. There was about 15 people raised their hand. And the leader said, you are the most important people in the whole room. I thought, like hell they are. Those new drunks get sober or get drunk, you haven't lost anything, but you lose an old timer like me now, you've really lost. And I was angry. Now, I love the meeting before the meeting. I like the meeting after the meeting. I didn't stay. Man, I split from that meeting that night angry. I was so angry, I was livid. And on the way home, my mind says, I know what I'll do. I'll fix those people. I'll get drunk, and then they're going to be sorry. I went into total fantasy. I wasn't going to hide the bottle anymore. I was going to put it out there on the coffee table, put my feet out on the coffee table, and if my husband didn't like it, tell him to go to hell. But I could see him going to the phone calling North Hollywood. Oh, I'm enjoying this. I can't tell you how I'm enjoying it. And he's saying, what did you do to her? And he said, what did we do? And he says, she's drunk. And he's saying, oh, my God, no. And they get in a caravan of cars, and they come over to my house at 12 step me. And they make amends, and I forgive them. And then they pick me up in the warm arms, and they take me back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm a newcomer again. Dear ones, had you kept me around your program, patting me on the back, telling me how wonderful I was, I could have stayed with you for years, very sick. But see, my sponsor by this time wouldn't give me 2 hours of undivided attention on the phone anymore. You people weren't patting me on the back and telling me how wonderful I was. You were busy working with a newcomer, as you should. And when all this left, and I didn't know what my deeper-seated problem was, I had no other alternative than to go back into a bottle to try and find the comfort. I was in such pain, I needed instantaneous relief. I didn't have a God of my understanding. I didn't have a program, so I had nothing. And with a foundation like this, you gotta go back. You can't stand still. If you don't go ahead, you gotta go back. And so on June the 11th, I got up that morning, And I cleaned my house because I didn't want to call in any slob, you understand? I had everything all fixed. Put my makeup on, my earrings, clean underwear in case something happens, you know, but they always told me to have clean underwear on. And I walked to the liquor store, bought the same old half pint, and come tripping home. Now, when you're married to a non-alcoholic, you know, they're real sneaky. They always find your supply and pour it down the sink, and you die until the next morning. So about 2.5 years before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, trying to find a hiding place one time, I looked up in the cupboard and I saw a vinegar bottle. Now, did you know vinegar and bourbon are the same color? So I poured the vinegar out of the vinegar bottle, poured my whiskey in the vinegar bottle, and I put it right up in the front of the cupboard. Now, my dumb old husband would come home and he'd keep sliding the vinegar bottle back and forth, looking all over for the bottle. He never found my supply. So instead of drinking out of a nice cocktail glass like some of these ladies, I slurped out of a vinegar bottle for 2.5 years. Real fancy drunk, you understand. Now, I have 16 months and 3 days. Circuit speaker. Wonderful sponsor. Wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Going to be different, right? Wrong. I went home, took the vinegar out of the bottle of the cupboard, poured the vinegar in the sink, poured the whiskey in the vinegar bottle, and took my first drink out of the vinegar bottle. 16 months and 3 days from the day I was granted this pearl of great price called sobriety. You know, my birthday was last month, and I have a pearl on, given to me by one of my groups. And this is my pearl of great price, friends. See, a pearl is formed in the shell of an oyster by pain and irritation. You take an oyster shell and it gets a crack in it, and some sand gets in there, and the oyster has to put some kind of a saliva thing out there to seal that over. And that's what a pearl is formed. And a pearl is formed by pain and irritation. Now, my sobriety has been formed, and my alcoholism, by pain and irritation. I now have a pearl of great price. And if you have a day's sobriety in this room, you have a pearl of great price. For God's sake, don't throw it away. If we had a pearl, I don't know if this is a real one or not. It makes no difference. It's a loving gift. But if I had a pearl as big as my thumbnail, I'd cover it by insurance and put it in a safe deposit box. What would be the difference if you lost that kind of a pearl? But don't lose your pearl called sobriety, because you may not get it back. I believe that we all have another drunk in us. Everybody in this room's got another drunk. But none of you know if you have any sobering up time left. Because, see, I thought, well, I'll get drunk, get this resentment out. They'll be sorry. I'll go back to AA. The door swings both ways, and I'll be fine. Well, let me tell you what happened. When I took the first drink and it burned to my throat, it was the first real realization I had that I had drank. It was someone had slapped me in the face and wakened me out of a dream that couldn't have been any more violent. And I thought, my God, what did I do? There goes 16 months of sobriety shot to hell. I was mentally drunk 3 months before I ever took that drink. When I took the drink, that was the last. You get drunk up here, love. This is where you get drunk. You get mentally drunk long before you reach for that drink. And if you don't talk, you don't ventilate, you don't tell people how you feel, you're going to build it up and build it up. And before you know it, you'll be reaching for that drink. Cunning, baffling, powerful, and oh my God, so patient. That bottle will sit there until it gets cobwebs and dust on it. It'll wait. And you just let your guard down. And remember that we have a terminal disease. We have a progressive disease. It gets steadily worse, not better. Even when you're dry, it gets worse. Well, when the whiskey burned my throat and I said, my God, what's happened? What have I done? I stood there terrorized. Nothing happened. And I thought, I knew all along I wasn't like those drunks over there. So I walked out in the kitchen to have what I thought was going to be my second drink. And what I tell you now was told to me by my sponsor and my husband. He was an outside salesman at that time, and he knew I was squirreled up. There was no Al-Anon in those days. He decided to break off the territory and come home and see what was going on. He heard me screaming a half a block before I got to the house. When he opened the door and came in, I was on the floor beating my heels and my fist, but I almost broke the bones in my feet. I had dry heaves, so I broke a blood vessel into my esophagus, and I'm vomiting blood from my nose and my mouth. When he tried to get me up off the floor, I went totally limp. As my eyes rolled up in my head, there was no whites. It was just red blood slits from the broken blood vessels in my eyes. Now, he was in terror, and he had a car, but he knew that he remembered in his mind there was a medical center a couple blocks. We just owned this house a short time. A couple blocks from our house, it was a medical center, so he just tore out of there. And he ran 2 blocks, and when he got up to the corner, there were 7 doors of a doctor's suites along the sidewalk, and he just came to the very first one that was available. Office was full of people. He went past the receptionist, past the doctor's receptionist, into the doctor's examining room. And he grabbed the doctor and said something like, my wife's been sober 16 months, and she's drinking. I think she's dying. Will you come? Now, the first of many miracles set forth for me, because he didn't say, get the rescue squad. Or am I got another drunk, or I've got an office full of people. Do you have hospitalization? Who recommended you? You know, they do all this, and I'd have been dead by that time. He just picked up his bag and left an office full of people and ran the 2 blocks of my husband. Do you know why? He was an alcoholic. One of 7 doctors, the only alcoholic in the building, the only one that would have come. Now, if you call that a coincidence, to me, it's a complicated way of spelling God. When he got there and put the stethoscope on my chest, he turned to my husband and he said, all vital signs are gone. There's no heartbeat, no pulse, no respiration. My husband got hysterical, and he said, I'll try one last thing. He took a long needle out of his bag, and he shot me directly into the chest cavity, gave me artificial resuscitation, and once again, by the grace of God, Dottie Shore started breathing. Let's take it back. Supposing Al had been a minute late coming home, the doctor hesitated 2 minutes. They would have brought my heart back. My brain would have been damaged beyond repair. You know how much I had to drink that morning? 3 straight shots of whiskey. It's not how much you drink, how long you drink, what brand, with whom, whether you're periodic, chronic. Can you guarantee what's going to happen when you take your next drink? I thought I could. I'll get drunk and I'll go back to AA. We all have another drunk, dear ones. I have no more sobering up time. For me to drink is to die, thank God. I think when we come through the doors of any Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, we're presented with some invisible pieces of paper. You have 1, 3, 10, I don't know how many you got. I call those pieces of paper sobering up time, return tickets. You see, I punched my last ticket. I don't have any more. For me to drink is to die, literally. Because on June 11, 1951, I was pronounced dead of an overdose of a drug called alcohol.